You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining me today for another program, another edition of Readings of Interest to the Jewish Community. My name is Michael Wolin. I'm going to start with a commentary on a double parsha this week, two parshas, Behar and Behukotai. And these are the last two parshas in the book of Leviticus. This is the end of the book of Leviticus. Our next parshas will be from the book of Numbers. Well, this commentary is by Rabbi Yonatan Sacks on these two parshas, and he calls it family feeling. Really quite interesting insights into this parsha. He says, I've argued previously in my commentary for Parsha Kedoshim that Judaism is more than an ethnicity. It is a call to holiness. In one sense, however, there is an important ethnic dimension to Judaism. It's best captured in the 1980s joke about an advertising campaign in New York. Throughout the city, there were giant posters with the slogan, "You have a friend in the Chase Manhattan Bank." Underneath one of these, an Israeli had scribbled the words, "But in Bank Leumi," which is an Israeli bank, "But in Bank Leumi, you have mishpacha, family. Jews are and are conscious of being a single extended family." This is particularly evident in this week's parsha. Repeatedly, we read of social legislation couched in the language of family. For example, "When you buy or sell to your brother, let no one wrong his brother." This is Leviticus chapter 25, verse 14. "If your brother becomes impoverished and sells some of his property, his near redeemer is to come to you and redeem what his brother sold." Leviticus chapter 25, verse 25. "If your brother is impoverished and indebted to you, you must support him. He must live with you like a foreign resident. Do not take interest or profit from him, but fear your God and let your brother live with you." Leviticus chapter 25, verses 35 and 36. "If your brother becomes impoverished and is sold to you, do not work him like a slave." And that's Leviticus chapter 25 again, verse 39. Your brother in these verses is not meant literally. At times, it means your relative, but mostly it means your fellow Jew. This is a distinctive way of thinking about society and our obligations to others. Jews are not just citizens of the same nation or adherents of the same faith. We are members of the same extended family. We are, biologically or electively, children of Abraham and Sarah. For the most part, we share the same history. On the festivals, we relive the same memories. We are forged in the same crucible of suffering. We are more than friends. We are mishpacha. We are family. The concept of family is absolutely fundamental to Judaism. Consider the book of Genesis, the Torah's starting point. It is not primarily about theology, doctrine, dogma, things like that. It is not a polemic against idolatry. It is about families, husbands and wives, parents, children, brothers and sisters. At key moments in the Torah, God himself defines his relationship with the Israelites in terms of family. He tells Moshe to say to Pharaoh in his name, "My child, my firstborn, Israel." That's Exodus chapter 4, verse 22. When Moses wants to explain to the Israelites why they have a duty to be holy, he answers, "You are children of the Lord your God." Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 1. If God is our parent, then we are all brothers and sisters. We are related by bonds that go to the very heart of who we are. The prophets continued the metaphor. There is a lovely passage in Hosea in which the prophet describes God as a parent teaching a young child how to take its first faltering steps. Quote, "When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. It was I who taught Ephraim to walk, taking them by the arms. To them I was like one who lifts a little child to the cheek, and I bent down to feed them." Hosea chapter 11, verses 1 through 4. The same image is continued in rabbinic Judaism. In one of the most famous phrases of prayer, Rabbi Akiva used the words, "Avinu Malkeinu," our Father, our King. That is a precise and deliberate expression. God is indeed our sovereign, our lawgiver, and our judge. But before he is any of these things, he is our parent, and we are his children. That is why we believe divine compassion will always override strict justice. The concept of Jews as an extended family is powerfully expressed in Maimonides' Laws of Charity. He writes, "The entire Jewish people and all those who attach themselves to them are like brothers." As Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 1 states, "You are children of the Lord your God. And if a brother will not show mercy to a brother, who will show mercy to them? And whom do the poor of Israel lift up their eyes? To the Gentiles who hate them and pursue them? Their eyes are turned to their brethren alone." This sense of kinship, fraternity, and the family bond is at the heart of the idea of Kol Yisrael Arevin Ze Baze. All Jews are responsible for one another. Or as Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai put it, when one Jew is injured, all Jews feel the pain. Why is Judaism built on this model of the family? Partly to tell us that God did not choose an elite of the righteous or a sect of the like-minded. He chose a family, Abraham and Sarah's descendants, extended through time. The family is the most powerful vehicle of continuity and the kinds of changes Jews were expected to make to the world could not be achieved in a single generation. Hence, the importance of the family as a place of education. Quote, "You shall teach these things repeatedly to your children," and the handing of the story forward, especially on Pesach through the Seder service, where that quote was from. Another reason is that family feeling is the most primal and powerful moral bond. The scientist J.B.S. Haldane famously said, when asked whether he would jump into a river and risk his life to save his drowning brother, "No, but I would do so to save two brothers or eight cousins." The point he was making was that we share 50% of our genes with our siblings and an eighth with our cousins. Taking a risk to save them is a way of ensuring that our genes are passed on to the next generation. This principle, known as kin selection, is the most basic form of human altruism. It is where the moral sense is born. That is a key insight, not only of biology, but also of political theory. Edmund Burke famously said that, quote, "To be attached to the subdivision, to love the little platoon we belong to in society, is the first principle, the germ, as it were, of public affections. It is the first link in the series by which we proceed towards a love of our country and to mankind." End quote. Likewise, Alexis de Tocqueville said, "As long as family feeling was kept alive, the opponent of oppression was never alone." Strong families are essential to free societies. Where families are strong, a sense of altruism exists that can be extended outward, from family to friends, to neighbors, to community, and from there to the nation as a whole. It was the sense of family that kept Jews linked in a web of mutual obligation, despite the fact that they were scattered across the world. Does it still exist? Sometimes the divisions in the Jewish world go so deep, and the insults hurled by one group against another are so brutal that one could almost be persuaded that it does not. In the 1950s, Martin Buber expressed the belief that the Jewish people, in the traditional sense, no longer existed. Knesset Yisrael, the covenantal people, as a singular entity before God, was no more. The divisions between Jews, religious and secular, Orthodox and non-Orthodox, Zionist and non-Zionist, had, he thought, fragmented the people beyond hope of repair. Yet, that conclusion is premature for precisely the reason that makes family so elemental a bond. Argue with your friend, and tomorrow he may no longer be your friend. But argue with your brother, and tomorrow he is still your brother. The book of Genesis is full of sibling rivalries, but they do not all end the same way. The story of Cain and Abel ends with Abel dead. The story of Isaac and Ishmael ends with their standing together at Abraham's grave. The story of Esau and Jacob reaches a climax when, after a long separation, they meet, embrace, and go their separate ways. The story of Joseph and his brothers begins with animosity, but ends with forgiveness and reconciliation. Even the most dysfunctional families can eventually come together. The Jewish people remain a family, often divided, always argumentative, but bound in a common bond of fate nonetheless. As our parsha reminds us, that person who has fallen is our brother or sister, and ours must be the hand that helps them rise again. Seems like elemental statements, but it isn't really. In fact, it's profound. And unfortunately, much of the world doesn't share these feelings. In fact, in the United States, there is an ongoing assault on family. And there was in the Soviet Union as well. That seems to be something that is inherent in communism. I think it's they can't stand competition. And competition can grow within a family. At any rate, wherever it comes from, it exists. And we can see it in, for example, the state wanting to assume a greater role for the responsibility of our children, for example. What values they're taught, how they are raised, what they learn in schools. Well, Rabbi Sacks and his commentary on this parsha, which is attitudes and values that are spread throughout Jewish morals and Jewish tradition and Jewish history, are about the family. Okay, well, let's move on a little bit. I have a variety of articles that I want to discuss, and let's just jump a few thousand years to modern times. And we have in the United States Congress several individuals who fashion themselves into a loosely knit group called the Squad, which is essentially anti-Semitic. And this story that I'm going to read is about an event, essentially an anti-Semitic, anti-Israel event, that they wish to hold in the capital. And a bit of an imbroglio around that and how this came out. I think kind of surprising. So let's start with Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Speaker of the House, who blocked Rashida Tlaib's anti-Semitic event in kind of an unusual and an epic way. And kudos to Senator McCarthy. Speaker McCarthy. Here's the story. While the House of Representatives may have been more tolerant of anti-Semitism under Nancy Pelosi's watch, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy is having none of it. McCarthy took decisive action Tuesday of this week by preventing an anti-Semitic event organized by Representative Rashida Tlaib, which was scheduled to be held in the Capitol building. He prevented it from taking place. The event, intended to commemorate the Nakba, a term used by Palestinians to describe the perceived catastrophe, that's what the word means, catastrophe, of Israel's establishment as a Jewish state, well, as a state, period. And it was expected to be attended by several anti-Israel groups, some with known links to terrorism. McCarthy's office confirmed to the Washington Free Beacon that he intervened to secure the Capitol Visitor Center space originally reserved by Tlaib for the anti-Semitic event. Instead, the speaker will lead a bipartisan briefing commemorating the 75th anniversary of the U.S.-Israel relationship. It's wrong for members of Congress to traffic in anti-Semitic tropes about Israel, McCarthy told the Free Beacon. As long as I am speaker, we are going to support Israel's right to self-determination and self-defense, unequivocally and in a bipartisan fashion. Rashida Tlaib, a member of the so-called Squad, faced criticism after it was reported by the Free Beacon that she intended to host the event in collaboration with various anti-Israel groups, some of which have expressed support for terrorism. McCarthy's intervention follows a letter sent Tuesday evening by a group of rabbis urging leaders in both the House and Senate to denounce Tlaib's event. It is not surprising, but appalling that the featured speaker at this event will be a member of Congress who describes the only Middle Eastern country to give equality and voting rights to both Jews and Arabs as apartheid. The Coalition for Jewish Values wrote in their letter to McCarthy, "We hope that our request will meet with your favorable response and that you will condemn this event in the strongest terms as soon as possible." According to the report, Tlaib was originally slated to be the main speaker at this event, alongside several organizations known for supporting the anti-Semitic Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions movement, the BDS movement. One of these organizations is Jewish Voice for Peace, which has been described as a, quote, radical anti-Israel activist group and has faced criticism for glorifying Palestinian terrorism. Additional organizations include Engage Action, a Muslim advocacy group that supports the BDS movement and alleges that Israel practices apartheid, and Americans for Justice in Palestine Action, an advocacy group that bemoans the so-called influence of Jewish money in American politics. The future of the event organized by Tlaib and her cabal of anti-Semitic groups remain uncertain in light of McCarthy's intervention. Okay, it says that it remains uncertain. Well, as I started this article with praise and kudos for Speaker McCarthy, what happened? By the way, this article was originally published in PJ Media. I didn't see it in any of the mainstream media that I looked in. Nothing about this. But PJ Media covered it. Well, if you want to know what happened with this event and with Ms. Tlaib, Representative Tlaib, who comes to her rescue? None other than Senator Bernie Sanders, a Jew who found a way to host Senator Tlaib's Nakba 75 event in the Senate office building. Well, the Michigan Congresswoman found an ideological ally for sponsorship of a way to spew her anti-Israel sentiments. Well, this article from the Jewish News Syndicate. After Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy canceled a Nakba Day event to be hosted at the United States Capitol, featuring a presentation by Representative Rashida Tlaib, the Senate wound up providing a new venue for it. The event, called Nakba 75 and the Palestinian People, took place Wednesday night with the sponsorship of Senator Bernie Sanders. In the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Hearing Room, located at the Dirksen Senate Office Building, Representative Cori Bush also attended. During her speech, Tlaib said that the Nakba, which means catastrophe in Arabic and refers to the establishment of the modern-day State of Israel, never ended. She said, each year, our country sends billions, she means money, to explicitly maintain an apartheid state and support ethnic cleansing without a second thought. Okay, that's what she said. The use of apartheid and ethnic cleansing lies were similar to accusations Tlaib made on Twitter earlier this month, and that earned the rebuke of Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, Gilad Erdan. The nine sponsors of the event were the Institute for Middle East Understanding, Americans for Justice in Palestine Action, Project 48, Democracy for the Arab World Now, U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, American Friends Service Committee, those would be Quakers, Virginia Coalition for Human Rights, Engage Action, and Jewish Voice for Peace Action. Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican from Louisiana, said he disapproved of the event, adding that the Capitol grounds should not be used as a pedestal to legitimize anti-Semitic bigotry, which was what the event was. Now, there was no organized objection to this event, other than what I've described to you. Nothing organized that came from either the House or the Senate. That is, from the House, only what Speaker McCarthy did. But that was not a House action. That was his action. And nothing whatsoever from the Senate. And kind of remarkable when you consider that the some of the most powerful characters in the Senate, Dianne Feinstein is one of them, and the senators from California, sorry, their names have escaped me just at this moment, none of them spoke out, not a word. There we have some idea of what's going on in our capital, at least the Democratic part of it. All right. On to the next one. Here's an article by Lazar Berman on Arab ties with Jerusalem. He thinks that maybe they're losing a bit of the polish that they had maybe a couple of years ago, at least when they're discussing passing eventually, approving the Abraham Accords. Well, he writes that for Israel's once potential Arab allies, ties with Jerusalem lose some of their sheen. The nation's image as the key to Washington is undermined by Biden's refusal to invite Netanyahu to Washington, and a response to the flare-up in Gaza didn't do much for its aspirations to lead an anti-Iran bloc. Last month, on Israel's 75th Independence Day, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office released a video which featured, among other things, the premier lauding the peace agreements that Israel has reached with Arab countries over the years, especially the 2020 Abraham Accords. Quote, "I intend to lead the expansion of this peace to unimaginable heights," he pledged in his recorded message to the nation. It is a promise Netanyahu has been offering since before his return to office late last year, and hardly a diplomatic meeting or speech goes by in which he or his foreign minister doesn't talk of such an expansion. But circumstances are making it ever harder for Netanyahu to bring more Arab countries, and especially the big prize of Saudi Arabia, into the circle of peace, as he calls it. Without a marked change in Netanyahu's relationship with the Joe Biden White House, and in the Prime Minister's control over his own coalition, that circle is not going to expand. There are two primary reasons that Arab countries have normalized relations with Israel in recent years, and two reasons primarily why others wait in the wings. For one, consider the region's volatility, which forces countries to choose sides between Iran and the West. For the latter group, along with states too broken to form a coherent policy like Sudan or Yemen, ties with the United States have traditionally been of paramount importance. But in recent years, America's Arab partners have sensed a shift in Washington that gives them a lot of reason to worry. After decades of sacrificing blood and treasure in pursuit of democratic experiments in Iraq and Afghanistan, there is no longer any appetite in either U.S. political party for significant military engagement in the Middle East. China, not Al-Qaeda, is the boogeyman of the moment, and the pivot to Asia and the Pacific that began under former President Barack Obama has only gained steam under his successor, Joe Biden. The countries that signed the 2020 Abraham Accords came with wish lists that they wanted from an increasingly disengaged America as a reward for signing the Accords, and Netanyahu was expected to go to bat for them with his friend Donald Trump, the now former American president. Morocco wanted support for its claims to Western Sahara. Sudan wanted off the terror list. And the UAE, United Arab Emirates, wanted F-35 fighter jets. Bahrain bolstered its position with Washington. But with Trump out of office, traditional American allies needed an advocate in Washington even more. Countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia came under very public attack with Biden over their human rights records and were unable to build the personal rapport with him that they had with Donald Trump. Israel, however, potentially, they believed, could offer a way back in. Saudi Arabia has even detailed a series of requests from Washington before it will sign an agreement with Israel. Secondly, consider Iran. Not only do the Gulf countries see the Islamic Republic as their prime adversary, but even distant Morocco cut ties with Tehran 5 years ago. No one in the region is under any illusion that Biden is going to order a military strike on Iranian forces or its nuclear program, leaving Israel as the only player actively fighting Iranian attempts to expand its control over the Middle East and to move closer to nuclear weapons capability. Overt ties with Israel not only send a deterrent message to Tehran, but also make it easier for Arab countries to carry out joint military exercises and to create a regional anti-Iran military infrastructure. Both these benefits, access to decision makers in Washington, and an improved posture against Iran, must come at an acceptable price for Arab leaders, who have to take the public sympathy for the Palestinians into account. In all of these regards, Arab countries see diminishing incentives to normalize with Israel alongside growing costs. One does not have to follow the U.S.-Israel relationship closely to notice the tensions. And leaders in Arab capitals are keen observers of the signals coming from both sides. A major point of contention has been the proposed judicial reform in Israel. Initially, U.S. officials said they didn't want to weigh in on what they viewed as an internal Israeli matter, but they have gradually moved away from that position, first issuing vague pronouncements when asked about the importance of independent institutions before shifting to more overt criticism. They have also displayed disapproval of comments made by far-right elements of Netanyahu's government. In March, Biden called Netanyahu to raise the issue of the reform personally. The White House then issued another statement of concern over Netanyahu's decision to fire Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. Biden said days later that Netanyahu would not be invited to the White House in the near term, noting his distress over the government's judicial overhaul effort and urging the premier to walk away from the legislation. The White House continues to reiterate publicly that Netanyahu is not invited to Washington. And most recently, just a week ago, the White House reaffirmed that Netanyahu is not invited to Washington. Every time a senior Biden official reminds the world that there are no plans to host Netanyahu, Israel's perceived value as an advocate in Washington decreases. Saudi Arabia cannot put much hope in an Israeli leader who is unable to get his own audience with Biden, who invited the UAE, United Arab Emirates, President Mohammed bin Zayed to the White House and flew to Jeddah to meet the de facto Saudi leader Mohammed bin Salman. Meanwhile, the potential domestic cost of recognizing Israel has gone up in Arab countries. Ben Gvir's Temple Mount visit less than a week after the government took office and Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich's call to wipe out the Palestinian town of Huwara after a terrorist attack is not anything Arab leaders want to be seen as supporting by signaling normalization agreements with Israel. The countries have already signed the Abraham Accords, have made their displeasure known in a number of ways in the wake of these developments, including avoiding high-level visits and publicly denouncing Israel. While Israel struggles to make diplomatic headway in the region, Iran and its allies are enjoying a winning streak. As Israeli leaders continue to dream of a deal with Saudi Arabia, Riyadh re-established ties with Tehran last month in April. Earlier this week, many of Israel's Arab partners met with Syria's foreign minister in Amman, Jordan, a short drive from Israel's border, as they work to end Damascus's isolation within the Arab world. The Assad regime did not try to hide that it intends to remain in Tehran's orbit, even as it accepts renewed ties with pro-Western Middle Eastern states. On Thursday, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi came to Damascus to meet his Syrian counterpart, Bashar Assad, and sign a series of long-term agreements, the first Iranian leader to do so in more than a decade. Raisi took the opportunity to gloat at his country's recent uptick in fortunes and mock Israel's struggles, after a tough winter of domestic protests and Western fury over its military support for Russia in the Russia-Crimea war. The supporters of the normalization of relations are facing protests and questions by their own people, and realize that there is no other path but to resist and stand against the Zionist regime, said Raisi. Netanyahu will likely get his invitation at some point, and his trademark caution around Gaza could be described as prudence. But one of his core campaign promises, that he is the statesman that can gather a coalition to stop Iran's nuclear program and make peace with the Saudis, is being undermined by the chaos in his coalition and his inability to control his right flank. Unfortunately for the prime minister, the very same ministers making life difficult for him in Abu Dhabi and in Washington know they can't be replaced. After breaking too many promises in the past, there are no other party chiefs in Israel who trust Netanyahu enough to sit with him in a coalition. So he finds himself in a bind, with no clear path out, increasingly distant from his goals, and beholden to the very partners driving him even further away from them. Well, there's no question that Netanyahu is in a tough spot. The United States alleges that one of the divisive issues between them is the judicial reforms that Netanyahu seeks. Any country with an allegedly independent judiciary would want the reforms that he seeks. One of them that stands out in my mind is who chooses Supreme Court justices. Well, in the United States, the administration puts forward their candidates, their names, individuals for our Supreme Court, and they go through a examination process that's bipartisan. Republican and Democrat alike weigh in, interrogate the nominee, try to find out what they can about how they'll vote on important issues, and decide. And if it can't pass the Senate, that individual does not sit on the Supreme Court. So it may be a Democratic administration and a Democratic nominee, but it's not an assured thing that it will pass, and same with the Republicans. Generally, as a courtesy, one party will respect the wishes of the other when it comes to Supreme Court justices. But not always, and there have been many Supreme Court nominees who have not passed muster, you might say, not been able to get through their hearings favorably, and are never put on the court. In Israel, however, there is no Knesset oversight of Supreme Court nominees, and they are chosen, if you can believe this, they are chosen by the Supreme Court itself in Israel. So the members of the court, very few people on it, just a few people sit on the court. I don't know the exact number, but it's fewer than sit on the court in the United States, not nine, less than nine. They decide who will be on the Supreme Court. So if someone retires or dies, they choose who will replace them. And as it turns out, and as it's happened over the years, the Supreme Court in Israel are left. They are strongly left. And they choose people to replace themselves who are strongly left. And so you tend to have that political tension continually, even when you have a right government. So right now, Netanyahu is to the right, and you have a Supreme Court that, out of the chute, is opposed to anything that he does. That's just a reform that he wants to make. He wants, that is Netanyahu, does not want the court to choose who will be on the court. They want it done in other ways. Another advantage that the Supreme Court in Israel has is that since there is no constitution in Israel, there is no bedrock body of law that they must follow, or supposedly must follow. And instead, very often, they make their own law. And they even have the power to interfere with the Knesset, which is the legislative body. And that is a power that Netanyahu wants to rein in. It's one thing to have an opinion, but it's quite another to actually have the power to create legislation. That's not a judicial function, but it can work that way in Israel. Well, those are just some of the reforms that Netanyahu wants for the court. And the Biden administration is opposed to them on principle, even though we wouldn't for a minute have the kind of Supreme Court that Israel has. The Biden administration is opposed to it simply because it will diminish the power of the left in Israel. And that's something that the left in the United States just doesn't want to see happen. So there's things behind the scenes, and you can see from this article that I just read by Lazar Berman, there's a lot going on behind the scenes. There's a lot at stake. Donald Trump literally, really, was on the verge of creating peace in the Middle East, an elusive goal. It's been elusive to American policymakers for 60, 70 years, ever since we became an ally of Israel and involved in the Middle East. The idea of Middle East peace has been very elusive, but it appeared that it could happen. We'll see what happens if Trump becomes president again. I'm sure he'll spend attention in a positive way for the strongest ally America has, the only democratic nation in the Middle East. Okay. Here's another article that I think you'll find interesting. I did. This is a question asked by Jonathan Tobin. Mr. Tobin is the executive editor of the Jewish News Syndicate, or Jewish News Service. He asked the question, can Israeli resilience inspire alienated Americans? Now, that's an interesting question, I think, as he talks about Israeli resilience. Yet Israel, in many respects, has really been divided recently around the Supreme Court issue and other issues, and what it's come down to is the left against the right, labor against Likud, that kind of a divide. And it's brought hundreds of thousands of people out into the street to demonstrate, both in favor and in opposition, just depending upon what your attitudes are. Well, that doesn't seem like Israeli resilience. What could he be talking about? Well, interesting. Here's what he says. After months of divisiveness, the country immediately united in the face of incessant rocket fire. Will a community unwilling to fight anti-Semitic progressives, meaning America, learn that lesson? Well, this week ending, Israelis had a rough week. The country was subjected to a barrage of nearly 1,000 rockets and missiles fired at it by Gaza-based Palestinian Islamic Jihad terrorists. Though for the most part, the Iron Dome air defense system did its work admirably, stopping 91% of projectiles, one got through and scored a direct hit on an apartment building in the central Israeli city of Rehovot, killing one man and wounding five others. But as is usually the case when their country is under attack from enemies who wish their destruction, Israelis pulled together, united behind the government, and carried on with normal life as much as possible. The resilience of Israelis in the face of challenges that might break other people is one of the most remarkable aspects of life in the Jewish state. The country has been torn apart in recent months by a bitter, divisive, and often disingenuous battle that was supposedly about Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's plans to reform the judiciary, but it really was a naked struggle for political power. While it would be an exaggeration to say that this was all forgotten amid the fighting, sirens, and air raids, this last week's events demonstrate that even in the worst of times, the vast majority of Israelis are able to rise above their differences and present a fairly united front to an often hostile world. Indeed, it was enough to frustrate the gaggle of anti-Zionist columnists at the Haaretz opinion section, who lamented the way Israelis put aside their politics and stood by their right to self-defense against people trying to kill them. That's kind of amazing. Haaretz is kind of the New York Times of Israel, and they have a strong anti-Zionist brigade there. The same cannot be said about many American Jews looking on the struggle in the Middle East with their usual mix of support, criticism, and plain old indifference. Here's a comment by Prime Minister Netanyahu. He said, "No country would ever tolerate rocket attacks on its citizens, and neither does Israel. We have a duty to protect our people against terrorism." That's a tweet by Benjamin Netanyahu. It seems very difficult to argue with that, but the anti-Zionists at Haaretz, and there are many of them actually in Israel, they would take issue with his statement. Well, it's true that most of those who played leadership roles in the Jewish community made statements expressing solidarity with Israel and opposing the terrorists. But as Jewish communities are in the process of holding some of their Israel Independence Day festivals, which are timed to happen May 14, as I'm speaking now, there was no massive outpouring of support for the Jewish state, as was the case in previous generations when it was under attack. With each passing anniversary, the hoopla among American Jews about Israel's birthday becomes less a matter of unified support and more a function of the growing alienation that some feel about Israel, even the very idea of a Jewish state. While many blame this on dislike of Netanyahu and his policies, it has little to do with him and everything to do with the changing demography of a community increasingly assimilated and lacking a sense of Jewish peoplehood. This is the American Jewish community he's talking about. With the fastest growing sector of American Jewry being what demographers label Jews of no religion, it's little surprise that a sectarian idea like Zionism would be a hard sell for those who feel no particular loyalty to their group identity. Still, and despite the cynicism and criticism heard from the liberal establishment about the Jewish state, we know that, as proven by the success of things like birthright trips, connection with Israel helps build a stronger sense of Jewish identity among Americans, especially at a young age. Though some on the secular left find it hard to admit, Israel remains the center of Jewish life and a singular source of inspiration for a people that date back 3,500 years. But the growing drift of Democrats, to whom most Jews remain loyal, away from Israel, is a measure of the alienation that cannot be ignored. More to the point, there was also little anger or political backlash when Democrats went silent about the way anti-Semitic progressives were allowed to hold a gathering lamenting the birth of Israel the Jewish state, and they called it Nakba 75 at a Senate office building under the sponsorship of Vermont Jewish Senator Bernie Sanders. The event was the project of Representative Rashida Tlaib, a Democrat from Michigan, who supports not just the anti-Semitic BDS movement, but openly calls for the destruction of Israel. She was thwarted from holding her Nakba Fest. Remember, Nakba means catastrophe. The catastrophe, of course, is Israel's modern-day establishment. Well, she was thwarted from holding that in the House by a decision of Speaker Kevin McCarthy, a Republican from California. But no one in the Democratic leadership of the Senate, including Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, or the Biden administration, sought to keep a program aimed at pushing for the destruction of the one Jewish state on the planet and the key U.S. ally off of government property. While some Jewish liberals might dismiss this as unimportant, Nakba commemorations, which center around declaring Israel's birth to be a crime that must be expunged, matter because it was a symbol of the growing influence of the intersectional left. Far from being isolated, the anti-Israel faction among Democrats is growing in number. More to the point, even at a time when Israel is under attack, the silence about the Nakba Day affair from Democrats was telling. Tlaib and her fellow squad members and anti-Semite, Representative Ilhan Omar, also Democrat from Minnesota, remain popular among the Democratic base. Moreover, even figures like President Biden are careful to cultivate them. That was made clear when both were invited to the White House last month for an Eid al-Fitr event, and the president singled them out for compliments. Democrats often blame Republicans for not isolating some of their more extreme members, like Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia, who, though a supporter of Israel, has made in the past bizarre comments easily interpreted as anti-Semitic. However, she has walked them back. Democrats are unwilling to do the same with Tlaib and Omar, despite their open and unabashed anti-Semitism and hatred for Israel, due to their being viewed as both progressives in good standing and pop culture rock stars. Their increasing influence is not unrelated to what's been happening in Gaza and Israel. 4 days of efforts by the Israeli Defense Forces, dubbed Operation Shield and Arrow, to take out the Islamic group's military capabilities and its leadership, did not succeed in completely silencing their fire. The IDF took its usual care in limiting the impact of their strikes on Palestinian civilians. But the inevitable casualties are being trumpeted by Israel's opponents as crime, even though many of those killed and hurt in Gaza were hit by Islamic Jihad missiles, which fell short of their intended targets in Israel. They actually fell within the Gaza Strip. The contrast between the Israeli and Palestinian casualties is depicted as the result of a disproportionate IDF response to the rockets. Yet, what it really shows is the difference between the two sides' priorities. In the Gaza Strip are plenty of bomb shelters. Underneath the entire strip lies a massive network of tunnels and fortified strongholds used for terrorist purposes. But they are used as weapon storage facilities for the people firing them. Israel has prioritized the defense of its people with both defense systems and mandatory bomb shelters. No bomb shelters for Palestinians. That hasn't stopped the media from engaging in the usual Israel bashing, as the actual intent of Palestinian groups like Islamic Jihad, as well as Hamas and Fatah, are downplayed or ignored. That has taken a toll, not so much on general American support for Israel, which is rooted in the overwhelmingly positive sentiments expressed by conservative Christians, evangelicals, and Republicans, while liberals and Democrats are more sympathetic to a Palestinian cause that demands the destruction, the distinction of Jews. The good news is that while American Jews are influenced by critical media coverage of the Jewish state, most Israelis know better than to treat their efforts to survive as depending upon the goodwill of the international media. The vast majority understand that there is no point in listening to the elite chattering classes of the West who wrongly view them as colonialists or white oppressors in their own country. For all of its problems, and they are legion, Israel seems uninterested in debating whether or not it has a right to exist or to defend itself. American Jews would do well to learn from this, rather than to think they need to save Israel from itself. As the anniversary of Israel's birthday is observed in the secular calendar this coming week, along with the Palestinians' Nakba, American Jews should pause and think of the stress Israelis face as they dash in and out of bomb shelters trying to get their kids to school or to sleep, and to take care of their neighbors, including the sick and the elderly. They should also be inspired by Israel's resolution in defending its people against those who seek their destruction, as well as by the ability of Israelis to temporarily put their differences aside in the face of deadly threats. This is a moment to recognize that the Israeli people's attitudes are not just admirable. Their strength and determination represent the future of the Jewish people. Well, I agree wholeheartedly. Well, that article is by Jonathan Tobin, editor-in-chief of the Jewish News Syndicate. And ladies and gentlemen, I see that we are just about out of time. So I want to thank you for joining me today for Readings of Interest to the Jewish Community and remind you my name is Michael Wolin. I'd also like to welcome you to listen to our next program and also to wish you a good Shabbos and Shabbat Shalom. Have a good week.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.